So this evening, we're going to be thinking about one of, if not the most difficult subjects, I think, when it comes to faith and scripture and God. The relationship between God and violence, and particularly the idea of God commanding his people to do violence. As I said, we're going to do the same thing we've been doing over recent times in services. I'm going to open the subject up and there'll be some time to discuss it. I'm going to start by reading to you a well-loved story from the Bible. If you grew up going to church, you probably have heard this story many, many times. I'm not going to read all of it, just a part of it. It's a story that we teach regularly to small children in Sunday school. Here it goes. This is the story of the fall of Jericho from Joshua 6. Sorry, before I start, all I've got in my head is, if any of you have ever seen VeggieTales, there is a thing from VeggieTales where they are marching round the walls of Jericho, these little vegetables, and they're throwing, like, I don't know, yogurts or like something down at them as they go. That's a real distraction. It's got nothing to do with what we're supposed to be doing. Let me read this to you. When Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets before the Lord went forward, blowing their trumpets, and the ark of the Lord's covenant followed them. The armed guards marched ahead of the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard followed the ark. All this time the trumpets were sounding. But Joshua had commanded the army, "Do not give a war cry. Do not raise your voices. Do not say a word until the day I tell you to shout, and then shout." So he had the ark of the Lord carried around the city, circling it once. Then the army returned to camp and spent the night there. Joshua got up early the next morning, and the priests took up the ark of the Lord. The seven priests carrying the seven trumpets went forward, marching before the ark of the Lord and blowing the trumpets. The armed men went ahead of them, and the rear guard followed the ark of the Lord while the trumpets kept sounding. So on the second day, they marched around the city once and returned to camp. They did this for 6 days. On the seventh day, they got up at daybreak and marched around the city seven times in the same manner, except on that day they circled the city seven times. The seventh time around, when the priest sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the army, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall be spared, because she hid the spies we sent. But keep away from the devoted things, so that you will not bring about your destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise, you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord and must go into his territory." When the trumpet sounded, the army shouted. And at the sound of the trumpet, when the men gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So everyone charged straight in and they took the city. They devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it. Men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep and donkeys. Let me just check with you something before I say anything else. How many of you did hear about that story in Sunday school when you were a small child? Anyone? Yeah. How many of you were taught in Sunday school that when the walls of Jericho fell, everyone rushed in and killed men, women, young, old, cattle, sheep and donkeys? Anyone hear about the slaughter of donkeys in Sunday school? We like to tell these stories, but we leave some important bits out. It's brutal, isn't it? Absolutely brutal. But it shouldn't be a surprise. You flick back to Deuteronomy. This is what God says to his people in Deuteronomy 20. "However, in the cities of the nation the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance," he's talking about when they go into the land, "do not leave anything that breathes. Completely destroy them. The Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Otherwise, they will teach you to follow all the detestable things they do in worshipping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God." This is really hard for me. I am passionate about telling people about a God who loves them. Who loves them so much he endured the cross for them. I want to help people get to deeply know that compassionate, patient, loving God. And yet passages like this seem to show us something different. The Bible is full of violence and pain. And sometimes the violence and the pain that we see in the Bible is entirely of human creation, right? The Bible is simply recording for us horrible things that some humans do to others. Sometimes it's indeed the Bible recording God's people praying to him that he would do violence, that he will destroy their enemies. And we don't necessarily need to say what's right or what's wrong. It's a record of what they did. We can read it and say, well, do you know what? Probably wasn't a good idea for them to pray that God would slaughter all their enemies. That doesn't seem like a very nice thing. But what is inescapable is some parts of the Bible present us with our loving God commanding his people to mass slaughter. I don't think it's often that Richard Dawkins gets quoted in church, but I probably gets quoted in church quite a lot, actually, thinking about it. Richard Dawkins, a prominent atheist, wrote this in one of his books. He wrote, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, he likes long words, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully." How do we respond to that? How do we who trust in a loving God respond? Because all too often, I think we gloss over or ignore the difficult bits, the violence. Like in Sunday school, when we don't, you know, we leave bits out, don't we? We don't necessarily tell the children that Rahab was a prostitute because that might lead to questions that we're not quite equipped to answer just yet. And we don't tell them that even the donkeys got killed when people went into Jericho. We try to ignore God commanding his people to genocide. We gloss over the angel of death wiping out the firstborn in Egypt and focus instead on those who escaped. We ignore the piece of law in Deuteronomy 21, which says that an unruly child should be taken outside of the city and stoned to death. Or the fact that whilst Noah was floating in the ark with his family and all those lovely animals, everyone else, and all the other animals, were drowning. Sometimes we dismiss these stories as an Old Testament problem and argue that things have changed under Jesus. But it is the same unchanging God, is it not? The New Testament tells us God never changes. We need to wrestle with these passages. I'm going to talk for far too long if I keep going on. We need to wrestle with these passages, right? Because people have used passages like this to justify all kinds of horrific things. A God who sends his people to slaughter others was preached on the eve of genocide in Rwanda. As white European settlers slaughtered Native Americans. As the Ku Klux Klan lynched black men and women. A God who commands violence has been used by people calling themselves Christians in Northern Ireland and Nigeria and Uganda and Nazi Germany in order to kill those they disagreed with. Not to mention more recently in the Russian Orthodox Church. We find these sorts of actions abhorrent. We believe these people are only selecting the bits of the Bible that fit their own agenda. But if we ignore the passages that we don't like, we are just doing exactly the same thing. So, how do we reconcile all this? Don't know. That's it. That's all I've got. We're going to use Joshua as a bit of a case study, and I'm just going to give you some possible mitigating circumstances to what was going on in the book of Joshua, and then I'm going to let you talk about it. So, The first mitigating circumstance for the conquest of the land in Joshua and God telling his people to slaughter everything that lived. Firstly, and for some of you this is going to be hard, okay? It's just a possibility I'm raising. Firstly, it is possible that what the Bible says happened might not be what actually happened. Now, you might be sitting there ready to throw me out as a heretic. Let me just lay it out for you a little. The argument goes like this. The author of Deuteronomy, where this slaughter is commanded, the author of Joshua, their first job, their primary aim as they were writing these books, inspired by God, was not to record dispassionate, unbiased history. In fact, this is true of most things that were written at a similar time. The idea that we can record history in a way that is completely dispassionate, just a list of facts, is really modern. It would be completely alien to anyone writing in those days. The Bible is written, and the authors of it wrote it, in order to tell us something about God and about his people and about the interaction between God and his people. It is primarily a theological book, not a historical one. And so in this account, there's a lot of rhetorical language being used. And so it is possible that kill everyone doesn't quite mean what we think it does. In fact, the best archaeological evidence and modern scholarship seems to suggest the Israelite campaign across the Promised Land wasn't anywhere near as swift and dramatic as it's presented here. It's a much slower process. Even when you look at it from a logical point of view, if the Israelite army turns up at a city and you are not a fighting person, the chances are before they get in and slaughter everyone, you've run out the back door, right? So some people must have escaped. The slaughter of everyone and everything seems strange. And before you tell me I'm being completely unbiblical, there are places in Joshua where the record is conflicting. So in Joshua 11, we're told that Joshua went and destroyed the Anakites from the hill country, from Hebron, Debir, and Anab, from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua totally destroyed them and their towns. And a little later in Joshua 15, some of those Anakites turn up in Hebron, which is a city that belongs to Caleb and his family, and they have to be turned out. So it tells us in one place they've all been slaughtered, and then some of them turn up. So we might argue the story's not as brutal as it first appears, not the genocide it first seems. I'm not sure how satisfactory that is. There are other things to consider. The way in which war is portrayed in other nations at the time, God's commands seem rather different, and we shouldn't judge what happened thousands of years ago by our own modern standards. So, for example, the destruction of your enemies, the complete annihilation, was pretty much the way of doing war in those days, as was torture and rape and general chaos. But the law that God gives to his people sets a different standard. So, and we've got to do this by the standard of the day, not today's standard. But in Deuteronomy 21, God is commanding his people about what to do when they go to war, and he tells them, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife. Bring her into your home and have her shave her head, trim her nails, and put aside the clothes she was wearing when captured. After she has lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, then you go to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. Now, this seems pretty awful to us. But this is in a world where the normal thing to do was to go in, you see a beautiful woman you like the look of, you raped her and moved on. God's saying, you can't do that. That's not how my people are going to behave. You're going to let this woman mourn, and if you really like her, you can marry her and you can look after her properly. That's your choice. It all seems a bit harsh, but not quite so bad as what was going on elsewhere. How are we doing so far? There's another thing. Joshua meets a messenger from God in chapter 5 of Joshua. And Joshua meets him and says, are you for us or for our enemies? And the messenger from God says, neither. But as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. says, "Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, 'What message does the Lord have for his servant?'" There is a lesson here, I think, in that the commander of the army of the Lord's was not necessarily on Joshua's side. The commander of the army of the Lord's was not just going to let the Israelite people do whatever they wanted as they went in conquest. Our God is not bending everything to make, is not supporting everything his people do in his name. We see that later. There's an argument too that the Canaanites deserve it. I find this quite hard, to be honest. But the idea goes that God's people sweeping through the land was divine judgment on those who worshipped idols and committed human sacrifice. In the same way God later uses the Babylonians to take his people into exile, here he's using his people to punish the sins of those already in the land. It's a possibility. There's no condemnation here or a chance for the people to repent like Nineveh will be given later. There's no pronouncement of judgment. It's just the Israelites set into battle. One final thing I want to say, and then we're going to split into groups and you can work out how what I've said is wrong and what you think about it all. One more thing, and it centers around the Hebrew word harem. Harem is, I'm saying that really badly, is a word that is translated in our Bible sometimes as utterly destroy. But this word harem is also used in other ways in other places. It is used to describe things that are utterly holy. The choicest of gifts that were to go into the temple of God were harem. And it's also used for things that are utterly profane and should not come anywhere near God's people. And what these two things have in common is that something that is harem is separate. It is not for normal use. It should be set aside either for destruction or for devotion. Harem, when used here, of the people, that phrase to utterly destroy, it certainly involves killing and death, but it is not always about killing and death. Some of the best scholars argue that the command to harem, to utterly destroy, is not primarily about killing everyone. It's about getting rid of their racial identity, which again, that might be hard for us too. Some of the people from Canaan could, like Rahab, be grafted into the people of God. They could come to belong. But their old identity, the people who already lived in the land, their old identity, their false gods, their pagan rituals needed to go, could no longer exist in the land. And so it was to wipe out them as a people rather than as individuals who could come and be part of the Lord's people. That's all I've got. You're probably completely unsatisfied with what I've got, which is why I'm going to let you split up into groups and come up with some better answers. So if you want to split into groups of, I don't know, you know, maybe three groups of five or so, I've got some questions for you which might help. If you don't want to answer the questions but just want to have a chat about, you know, a cheery chat about genocide, then you can do that instead. But we'll talk about it for 5 or 10 minutes, I guess, until you can't cope anymore. You might need to move in order to have some sort of group discussion.